Welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. With widespread disinformation, particularly on social media, what are the effects on democracy, and particularly on democratic discourse? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. With the news that Elon Musk intends to purchase Twitter, with promises that the social media company will allow a wider range of content, including some that have been previously banned, such as hate speech, conspiracy-centric speech, are most notably disinformation. Our concerns about disinformation in political discourse have been heightened. But this is not a new issue. Social media seems to speed the process, but it didn't invent disinformation. A significant concern about disinformation, though, is who gets to regulate what constitutes disinformation, considering the political power of groups that could censor. On today's show, we will explore the challenge of disinformation to democratic discourse and potential policies to address it. And we have a particular commitment to freedom of speech, but a desire to ensure that our discourse is not poisoned by clear campaigns to misinform. Our panel today is Corneliu Biola. He is Associate Professor in Diplomatic Studies at the University of Oxford and head of the Oxford Digital Diplomacy Research Group. He is the author of Countering Online Propaganda and Violent Extremism, The Dark Side of Digital Diplomacy, and Digital Diplomacy Theory and Practice. Nora Benavides is Senior Counsel and Director of the Digital Justice and Civil Rights at Free Press. She also is a faculty associate at Arizona State University's Cronkite Institute, where she teaches a course on freedom of expression in the digital age. She's the author of numerous pieces, including Facebook Ought to Be Protecting Democracy Every Day in the Boston Globe, and First Amendment Rights If You Agree with the President in the Atlantic. And Elzbieta Draskowitz, Senior Research Fellow at the Institute for Sociology, the Slovak Academy of Sciences. She is the co-author with Jaron Harambom of What Should Academics Do About Conspiracy Theories? Moving Beyond Debunking to Better Deal with Conspiratorial Movements, Misinformation, and Post-Truth, and Taking Vaccine Regret and Hesitancy Seriously, The Role of Truth, Conspiracy Theories, Gender Relations, and Trust in the HPV Immunization Programs in Ireland. Thank you all for joining us today, a topic of disinformation. So I guess as we start, Corneliu Biola, what do we mean by disinformation?
Thank you very much, Douglas, for inviting me, and many thanks to the audience, you know, for listening to us. So let's start, yes, with the basics. So what exactly we mean by disinformation? And the traditional way in which we think in the academia about disinformation are actually two categories, and there is an interesting distinction between the two. First one is disinformation. We refer basically to false, verifiable false or misleading information that is created and disseminated with intention to, you know, sometimes, you know, to deceive the public, otherwise, you know, to make economic gains or political gains. A second category is misinformation. And misinformation bears the same type of features, but it lacks intention in the sense that, you know, you spread disinformation, you spread false information, verifiable, sort of, without knowing that it's false or you believe that it's true. Sometimes the distinction between them, you know, it's academic, but I think it has, you know, legal implications as well. I think one question that arises, because we discuss now about this information, it's, you know, about the drivers. People sometimes associate this information mainly with state actors. Think about what happens in Ukraine, but also with Russian campaigns since, you know, in the past decade. But I think there are three main drivers. They are people who want to make it for economic gain, right? Deceive information because, you know, they want to attract attention so that they can earn some income from YouTube and the other platforms. You know, the more audience you have, the more ads they come. That started to be a little bit blocked at the moment, you know, by platforms because of the pressure from regulators and also from the public. There is a second category. It refers to people who want to make for electoral and political gain. Power political parties learn that, you know, lies pay off. There were some studies, you know, published recently showing that about 30% of this information comes actually from domestic actors. This is important because when you have external actors, it's one thing because you know how to deal, or you know, it's easier in a sense to deal with. When you have domestic actors, it touches on exactly what Douglas mentioned, you know, the problem of free speech, how to deal with that. And there is a third actor, a third category, which refers to state actors, external actors, Russia, China, Iran. These are the big ones that have been using this information for strategic purposes, right? To create chaos, to create instability in target countries, and to produce realignment, political realignment with certain policies. We've seen the effect of that in the case of Brexit. There was discussion about US election in 2016. There is campaign, you know, an inquiry nowadays about what happened on the 6th of January. So we have examples around about how these external actors may interfere. But this is a big problem. And we talk more about this because of the problem of social media. Exactly that, how we started. Social media makes this kind of disinformation travel faster. We have studies proving that negative stories, you know, false stories, you know, travel quite because people share it more. They have more interest in producing this kind of sensationalist or disseminating this kind of sensationalist stories. It's also more difficult because of the avalanche of information, the amount of it is more difficult to counter, right? How do you counter? In the past, we have campaigns to counter certain disinformation about AIDS in the 1980s that was disseminated by Russia. You have, keep in mind, you know, in 1980s, when Russia started to disseminate that story about AIDS that leaked from an American lab, 1986, it took about 2 years. 2 years from the moment it was leaked to circulate through Indian media and then reverberate, percolate, you know, the American media. 2 years, I mean, in the social media, this is 24 hours, right? So it's fast, it's a lot, it makes it more difficult to attract, and it's also very addictive. Disinformation social media is performative, it affects your identity, it creates communities of believers. It creates these bubbles that we talk, echo chambers and so on. It creates community of believers, which find their identity reflected, but also reinforced by this kind of discourse. And why is that important? Because they move from the screen, from the front of the screen, as we know right now, to the street. So what happens online doesn't stay online. It moves offline and has repercussions in at the ballot box or, you know, 6th of January type of events. So just not to monopolize the discussion, introducing a little bit, you know, the what this information means, but also why are we talking more about it at the moment?
Yes, absolutely. And it's a really great way to, I think, to classify, you know, these different types of campaigns. Nora Benavidez, I think one of the great concerns, though, with respect to disinformation is then, I guess, you know, what do we do with these campaigns? I mean, the internet is perhaps one of, if not the greatest libertarian institutions in the promotion of things like free speech, free expression. But we're talking about kind of the dark side, the dark underbelly of what all that means. So how do we manage our desire for free speech and expression with our concerns about the kinds of outcomes that disinformation can lead to?
Well, it's great to be here with all of you. And Cornelio, I thought you did an excellent job laying out some of the sort of, you know, backdrop of what all of the various wrinkles are to this phenomenon now. And it's just, we're really juxtaposed against something like the 1980s or even earlier. It is such a chaotic and voluminous problem now, you know, to even wrap our arms around and describe fully what disinformation looks like in practice and how it affects people is incredibly difficult. And no matter what or the sheer volume of researchers and experts looking into this issue, there are a number of problems and barriers. One of them is the lack of transparency by social media companies as to their role in all of this. As my fellow guest mentioned, there is sort of mounting evidence that social media companies play a significant part here. much of that is due to the shifts in information consumption, and that with the advent of the digital age, more and more people have moved across the world to using social media as their gateway or pathway to information. We are seeing declines across the world in funding for and options for credible journalism. People are turning to not just disinformation, but a range of low quality content, you know, junk news, what we might call pink slime websites, which have barely a whisper of credibility, malinformation, which is essentially real information that has been taken out of context in some manner. There is, of course, satire and humor. And we are all then publishers in this space together. You know, we have the ability on social media to publish something, to post it. And once it's out in the ether, the question is, what is the reach? And of course, the reach of the most incendiary and vitriolic content is greater in many instances. It gets more eyeballs for a number of psychological reasons. And of course, it makes money. And so social media companies are in a position where they are profiting off of a bottom line, where they're really feeding us, in many instances, force feeding, giving recommended content that is no longer the next door neighbor's puppy or someone's niece. You know, we've moved very rapidly over the last many years since the advent of social media to something where we have a growing sense that social media companies have a role to play, as well as other stakeholders. And I often break down the various kinds of interventions into the individual, to then the policy or regulatory, and then what companies and corporate accountability actions can look like. I start with the individual because, as I mentioned, I really believe we have to think about the internet we want and feel like we could be empowered actors, you know, whether that is through media literacy and other disinformation defense trainings from early age through adulthood. While there is mixed results when it comes to the efficacy of media literacy, some level of training and information about how we consume, what we consume, learning to think with curiosity and ask questions, that kind of individual intervention is critical. And there are a number of amazing people who are doing work around the world on this. I also then think primarily now in my role at Free Press as a sort of policy and corporate expert on what do we do when it comes to regulating the problem. And we can't do you can't regulate everything here, but you can do some of that. And there is a balance between the regulatory interventions we may employ and then the other kinds of actions that companies themselves must take to become more accountable. And briefly, what these are, I would probably start with the things that companies need to do, because it's within the bounds of that that then we may assess how regulation should happen. Much of what I frame our kind of conversation today around is companies are largely failing to make platforms safe. Partly that is because of the algorithms that they employ. That they are redlining users based on identity, extracting data about each of us, forming a kind of identity or profile of us, and then giving us content and often in many instances, excluding certain users based on identity from seeing content. At the same time, they are using algorithms that in some instances, and engineers don't even fully grasp what the intended and unintended consequences are. These are sometimes resulting in the amplification of disinformation, amplification of content that disenfranchises voters, health disinformation, it runs the gamut. But the first step in meaningful accountability is addressing the preferencing of this hateful and misleading content. And that is through a number of audits of what algorithmic processes look like across platforms. The second is a growing problem that we've seen recently illuminated through entities like Gizmodo, other, you know, the Facebook papers and whistleblowers recently that have really shown a light on the asymmetries when it comes to moderation and enforcement across language. Unfortunately, English language content gets most of the moderation and enforcement resourcing across platforms. And yet, English is by no means the only and certainly not one of the top leading languages. There are several other, dozens of other leading languages spoken around the world. In 2022 alone, we are seeing 36 determinative national elections around the world. And yet most of the resourcing on companies like Facebook, Twitter, that's all going towards English disinformation, not other languages, Spanish, Portuguese, French. I could rattle off more. We're going to see elections, you know, all over the world. And so companies need to really realize that the reach and the vulnerabilities are across language. And then finally, I think I would just mention transparency, that we're still dealing with what many call a black box. We don't fully know what companies are doing. In many instances, companies themselves don't. And it's a kind of easy argument to pass the buck that they are always and perennially in a startup mode, that no one quite knows what's happening in another division of a company. And yet, really, that isn't good enough. We have to be demanding more information and disclosures about business practices, moderation, enforcement practices, other business models that move and keep a company going. So those are some of the corporate demands. I'll just briefly say that on the policy and intervention side, that is incredibly, incredibly diverse. And the options before us, you know, we are seeing the Digital Services Act move in the EU. Congress here in the United States has had quite a few stops and starts trying to think about how do we protect privacy and user privacy online, enhance data transparency. I personally, you know, my background is as a civil rights lawyer, and I think about how disinformation is a civil and human rights issue. And I think that we have to be applying existing civil and human rights frameworks to the harms that we know are happening online. As Cornelio mentioned, there is absolutely a relationship from online to the offline world. And so our regulatory frameworks must advance with the times and see that to fully protect democracies, we have to be employing interventions that would otherwise disrupt the business models that allow disinformation to take hold so meaningfully in societies.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing disinformation online and campaigns to try to address this with Cornelio Biola of the University of Oxford, with Nora Benavides of Free Press, and with Ella Draskowitz of the Slovak Academy of Sciences. And so, Ella Draskowitz, let's turn and address this question of disinformation and fact-checking, the role that the different companies can play, but certainly academics have played this role, et cetera, at just identifying what exactly is the disinformation. How effective are these different fact-checking campaigns at countering some of the disinformation?
There is definitely a big push now for those kind of activities, and we see proliferation of NGOs getting involved in this kind of activities, new NGOs, new alliances being built with media, between different media across countries. So there's definitely hope that this is a solution. However, I would like to think about this kind of disinformation as a part of a bigger issue, which some people might see as conspiratorial thinking or some other form of expressing dissatisfaction, distrust with mainstream, whatever mainstream in whoever, you know, whichever part of the world media information we can see, or distrust towards what states provides, right? And I think when we look at it with the bigger picture in mind, then we might realize that even though those acts of speech, those communicative acts appear to be obsessing about facts and information, I think very often they are also about values and worldviews. And they act as a confirmation bias, you know, a way to confirm a person's view. But it is much harder to counter a person, you know, to change person worldview, value system, just by telling them that this one fact is wrong. So I think we have to take a bigger picture here. And when we take that, then we might see that countering is not that effective. I worked in Ireland where I was examining and investigating the conflicts over a HPV vaccine. In a nutshell, the program was success until it was not, and they have seen 30% drop over 1 year in a vaccination uptake. That's huge. And the question was, why did that happen? And the first answer that came to medical experts, to state admin, was, this is misinformation. These are rumors, right, that are at blame. But why do people believe those rumors? Can we so quickly jump to the conclusion that all people are so gullible in Ireland? But my study showed that those rumors were believable because of the larger historically rooted problems with healthcare in Ireland and with the specifically healthcare for women. So that's why people believed rumors that vaccine can cause harm, because there were earlier instances where welfare services were not supporting women or were directly working against their interest. So people took cautious and were taking a step back. What was good that state too, like the action that state took, was not so much countering misinformation, they did that as well, but also working towards strengthening trust in healthcare services and putting doctors on the front line of information campaigns and showing, look, we really care about you. It is not about us, about the state, it is about you. I think that was important messaging. I'm grateful that people do fact-checking. It helps me very often when I'm not sure about information to go and check if that information is correct or not. But I'm not sure if this will really change everybody's mind. What I would encourage is definitely education. I not only work at the Academy of Sciences, I'm also a teacher in primary school, and I work with children, and this is a big part of education, I think, also because the way we consume media really changes. It is like curatorial, every one of us is now a curatorial editor, if you will. We have to pick and choose what we want to read. It's not just one newspaper that we will go through. So I think we have to give those skills to new generations and to older generations and ourselves, like how to be this curator, how to be an editor, if you will, and you know, choose what is important, what not. I'm very always interested in listening about the question of regulation. You both, Corneliu and Nora, mentioned that. And I think there is a difference, also cultural difference, between Europe and the States. How are we worried about regulating the media and such things? But I'm coming from Poland. I'm Polish. And I find it very also interesting how differently we react to disinformation, to conspiracy theories in Eastern Europe and in Western Europe, if you will, and how in certain parts it can create moral panic, which I find interesting. For instance, during COVID, we were so concerned in the West about misinformation, disinformation, about conspiracy theories. And the outcome was vaccine programs were super successful. Why we were worried about a small group, maybe not United States, but that's a different story. So why are we so worried about it? That's also interesting for question for me. While in the Eastern Europe, where there is so much of this disinformation, also what Corneliu said, coming from the state, this issue is creating a little bit of less of moral panic. And I feel that there is something interesting here to look at, why we so differently look at those issues and how differently we deal with them.
And Corneliu, a lot of times when we think of countering disinformation, the emphasis has either been on fact checkers. We're going to circle back to the role of academics as fact checkers here, or of some sort of agency that might identify, or even the media company itself, Twitter, self-regulating and deplatforming certain individuals. But I know you do work on digital diplomacy and some of the state-to-state actions. How effective are state responses to state disinformation campaigns?
I think this is a big question for Ministry of Foreign Affairs, for diplomats, for government in general. But let me start responding to this by adding a few thoughts to what Delala so nicely and Nora so nicely put in terms of regulation, but also in terms of the sources. We think about this information as something that comes out of the blue, but Ella pointed out that it's not. Sometimes this is a symptom that we see with social media being activated. So what is a symptom? What we see nowadays is that, and there are books to prove this, is that in periods of great transformation, structural transformation, there is this kind of social anxiety. And these messages, especially conspiracies and this kind of disinformation, click. There's an interesting book was published in 2014 by a group of academics, I think in Florida, with Oxford University Press, speaks about American conspiracy theory. And they look back to 100 years of how various conspiracies have evolved in the American political environment. And they saw spikes in the 1930s, you know, big spikes in the 1930s because of the economic depression, big spikes in the 1950s. Why? Because of the Red Square and the threat of nuclear war. There were other spikes in between. So the point being that when there are periods of transformation, people require want answers. And one problem with this kind of disinformation conspiracy is that they provide an answer. It's a wrong answer, but it's a simple answer. So just to build a little bit on this, at the beginning of the pandemic in March 2020, I was monitoring a little bit what kind of disinformation is popping up in UK. And there were different stories. And I said, which one should I focus on? And there was one, you know, on the margin of the political sphere, of the public sphere, about the 5G towers. I said, well, nobody's going to buy this nonsense, you know, and I'm not going to pay attention to that. Guess what? In about a month, about 70 5G towers were burnt down by people in UK, right? Speaking about how things move from online to offline. This is not, you know, something, right? I mean, burning down. So the police had to intervene and say, so the question was, why these people, you know, all of a sudden identified the source of the pandemic with the 5G? There was a conspiracy. I'm not going to dwell much on this. There was a conspiracy trying to explain that, look, what the cause of the pandemic is driven by this. And they feel threatened and they wanted to react to the threat. And the way to react to the threat is to destroy the threat. So in a sense, in periods of transformation, we see now there is a big war in Europe, you know, Ukraine, you're going to see more and more of that. So that's one factor. We have to understand that this disinformation thrives in conditions of chaos, thrives in conditions of social transformation. This is where is stability, where things, you know, go okay-ish, you should expect less of that. But when there is anxiety, when there is transformation, people need answers. Now, going back to the question of how to counter some of the stories, some of the solutions are better than others. The problem for Ministry of Foreign Affairs and for others is that the lack of resources. So when you see, you know, 100 stories popping up today, which one are you going to address? You have, you know, two or three people, limited budgets, and so on and so forth. So that you try to collaborate with the big tech platforms. This is what, you know, for instance, UK government has tried to do. They develop capacity for some time. They work together with Facebook, with Twitter to try to contain some of the story, and they've been quite successful. But another element that we have to take into account is something that I've been focusing more recently in my research is the role of narratives. Narratives have become so huge in terms of understanding this information. It's not a piecemeal element, a tweet here and there, a tweet in which, look, you know, Douglas, you know, it's, you know, this and that. It's not about that. It's about how Douglas, as an actor, is placed in a bigger narrative. And what is a narrative? And I think it's a narrative story that we're going to, we've seen nowadays. It's a script. It's like a story, right? It always starts with a problem. Usually it's a victimization. Problem of victimization, you know, certain groups, you know, feel that, you know, they are discriminated. And there is a villain. There is a villain that it's very horrible, that is trying to continue this kind of unfairness and victimization. There is a drama. There is a condition in which this conflict has to be resolved. And there is a moral evaluation, it's prescription, how to get rid of this. So while I was researching, for instance, the question of the 5G, I went down the rabbit hole. I didn't expect, you know, to, I was looking for the 5G because it attracted my attention with the people, you know, burning them down. And then I went the rabbit hole, and on the rabbit hole, you find all kinds of craziness. And there was, for instance, you know, an entire infrastructure related to the New World Order that is driven by this kind of very secret Kabbalah, you know, with people on all kinds of things. They want to depopulate, and the Kabbalah makes, you know, Bill Gates and all kinds of Soros, of course, you know, there's a lot of anti-Semitism there as well. They want to depopulate. There is a crime that is happening that victimizes certain people. And of course, the solution how to get rid is to bring it back to the people. And if necessary, we need to fight. We need to fight with the real fight, right? So that was one. We see nowadays also with Russia, there is a theme, they push. I mean, I've been looking at Russian disinformation for some time, and the narrative are very, very there, out there, you know, with the decadent West that always try to persecute Russia. And there is a black and white situation. So narrative is important. So this is why now the solution to countering disinformation is to understand the narrative, understand the, you know, how these narratives work and how to work against them. Narratives are full of contradictions. They have a weak point, so you can actually interfere in them. So there is a little bit of push, and this is where these new units that were established in Ministry of Foreign Affairs, they are called strategic communication units. This is not propaganda. I'm not talking about propaganda. You don't fight propaganda with propaganda. You lose immediately. It's the strategic communication. They monitor the space, they understand the narrative, and then try to offer something that can actually work against. So it's a painful and steady and long fight. But I think the addressing that information on a piecemeal basis is not working. You have to look at the big picture. Sorry for talking, for expanding too long.
No, quite all right. With that, we will take a break. And when we return, we will continue this conversation about narrative versus discrete pieces of information as a way to counter disinformation.
When we come back, how can we best address disinformation and conspiracy theories? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. All over the world, disinformation has spread, shifting politics and challenging democracies. What are the most effective ways to counter disinformation? And how might it be different for states than for individuals? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Our panel today is Cornelia Biola, an associate professor in diplomatic studies at the University of Oxford and the head of the Oxford Digital Diplomacy Research Group. Nora Benavides, senior counsel and director of digital justice and civil rights at Free Press and a faculty associate at Arizona State University's Cronkite Institute. And Ella Dreskowitz, senior research fellow at the Institute for Sociology at the Slovak Academy of Sciences. So, Nora Benavides, you had some response to this question of approaching this issue as a narrative, as opposed to necessarily just discrete pieces of information.
Thanks so much, Doug. Well, Cornelia, I love listening to you. I think this is just so wonderful. I have, you know, long felt we are missing the mark when we describe human susceptibility to disinformation as anecdotal because of a single piece of content someone sees, and that many of the interventions, the kind of micro and individual training and suggestions we often give are, here is how to fact check a single headline. That is necessary, but it will never really get at the ultimate problem of our vulnerability. And, you know, in the lead up to the 2020 election here in the United States, I trained and worked with about 50,000 voters. One of the most interesting phenomena that I saw during that time was really a distancing. Almost no one, I would say, ever felt they themselves were victims of or targets of disinformation, nor did they feel they would ever be susceptible. And so it's often this kind of abstract concept that's over there, like it affects other people. And yet when you really talk to people about rumors and whispers and where their values sit, we're all susceptible in different ways. And so singling out a single headline or an image and that it was miscaptioned and trying to help people understand that that can be dangerous, that's frankly the easy part. The harder part is unthreading that many of these narratives and the underlying values that support our susceptibility are interwoven. So the reason you may be susceptible or anyone may be susceptible to health-related disinformation about the vaccine, the COVID vaccine, is because of having come from an authoritarian country where, of course, there are doubts as to government and corruption. Or if you are a Black individual in the United States and you know that your grandfather was experimented on during the early 1900s, for medical purposes, there will be legitimate reasons to be skeptical of something like a vaccine and its efficacy. Likewise, then, if you look over and say, well, election disinfo is totally unrelated, that isn't right because these narratives don't exist in sort of completely separate ecosystems. They are all part of one large and messy way that we engage with information. And so you can't pull one single one apart and say, ha, we solved it. This is how we can address this one topic, because they're all interwoven. As I sit here and think about, the great expanse, we're not that different from the way we were in early United States. We often think we are more divided than ever. And I try to disavow us of that. We were enclaved and separated, and early colonial United States settlements were divided and full of rancor, full of propaganda, full of rumors about different towns. These are in many ways also the symptoms, as disinformation is a symptom. And I think that if we're really going to address the problem, which we spend quite a bit of time defining in civil society and in the research communities, we have to move beyond the anecdotal or the single piece of content type of way of thinking about it. That yes, that is one avenue we have to address, but that there's the much larger problem that these narratives really weave together for all of us. And they're all based then on the identities and the backdrops and the trust that we might have or the distrust we have in institutions.
I think that's a great point. And just to interject slightly here as well, the idea of the rejection of medical, expertise, certainly in the United States, dates back to the founding of the Republic. I've done research on the 1918 pandemic and saw just how much skepticism there was about public health, at that point for precisely, for some of those same reasons. And I always like to tell my own students to differentiate between something I think we all would advocate for, because I mean, we have been on the panel, which is critical thinking, critical analysis, and tied to media literacy. And I like to contrast that with cynical thinking, cynical versus critical thinking. The cynic says the government always lies. The critic asks, under what conditions might the government lie, and figure out what might be the motivation behind that. Absolutely endorse the notion of greater critical analysis, greater critical thinking, and that this is not something that's necessarily new. But Ella Dreskowitz, you also have a response to this question.
I totally agree with my colleagues here. I think that what I really would like to emphasize that for disinformation, for conspiracy theories to stick, to gain traction, they have to resonate with something that is there before. So if people get interest in disinformation that has anti-Semitic traits, there probably has been anti-Semitism earlier already within that person who is susceptible to this. Because if there wasn't, there would be reaction which would reject that kind of information and be like, that's outrageous, I don't want to read that, rather than continuation of reading. So I think we really cannot underestimate this background, the structure that was there before. I think it would be naive to think that just disinformation creates that. I think it requires from us as researchers or social activists also recognition that there is some issues which were there before. And what I would also encourage is not to put every theorizing and every disinformation, every kind of theory into one bucket. And I would encourage us to think about them in the, you know, like to really look carefully at different locations and different places. We did research with Elisa Sobo during COVID about one specific conspiracy theories where people express the notion that the government is lying to us, right? The government is hiding the truth. And it was very interesting how in Ireland, Poland, and United States, this one claim, which seems to be universal and everybody says that, had very different meanings and was said for different reasons, right? In the United States, the fear that the government is lying to us about COVID resonated with the death of the American dream, with the notion this is an ultimate step to kill the dream because they don't want us to be successful. They don't want us to thrive. They want to lock us down so that we will never achieve the dream. While in Poland, the idea the government is lying, is not telling the truth, was connected, for instance, for some people with the idea the government is already so corrupt, they want to gain more power and they are not telling the truth. But here, the meaning of not telling the truth was they are underestimating the COVID, right? They are hiding the numbers. The COVID is bigger than they are telling us. Interestingly, in that case, even all those claims had, you know, characteristic of conspiratorial thinking. You know, there was someone who believed there is a plot, that there are people in power who are hiding the truth, who are doing something to harm others. These can be characteristics of conspiratorial thinking that never received the label of conspiracy theory, because people who were saying that in a hope of defending democracy. So I think different theories have different meaning for people, even when they appear as if they were universal and the same. And that's why I think it's important to tailor solutions to very specific local contexts. So this is what I would definitely encourage. And I would also say that it is easy to go for solutions thinking that people who that day, others who think, who believe in conspiracy theories, like Nora said, they are not us, like, this would never happen to me. There are someone else. So those people, once we identify them, once we do research of what characteristic the person who believes in conspiracy theories has, they will be this, 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 and that. Once we will be able to identify them, we will reform them, educate them. I don't know, we will do something to them. But I think, as we said before, a lot of reasons why people go into conspiracy theories can be because something happened in history, something real. There are actual valid and solid reasons, which if we take seriously, it might require looking also at us, at community of researchers, how we communicate science, how transparent are we about our research, how are patient-doctor relationships looking like, right? It's not only about minorities or regimes, it's about simple medical care for women. So much of decisions about vaccines are done by women who have to make decisions for their babies, right? So how does maternity care look like? What access do women have? How they are treated by doctors? And they are not always treated perfect, and not only in the, you know, in the poorer countries. So I think we also have to be open to the possibility that we can make a change within us to influence the reality. And this can, I know that some medical professionals might have self-defensive reaction to it, right? This is, you know, we are the laudable profession, we cannot be at blame, but I think it's actually quite liberating to realize, hey, actually I can do something. I'm not, like, I can improve my relationship with a patient. So many of people I interview, they say, I go to the doctor, I ask about vaccine, and they start to shout at me that if I'm not reasonable, I don't have to be their patient, I can leave. This is not way to convince someone, right? So keep them in as long as you can. Keep the conversation going, I would say. And lastly, I would say, you know, in divided societies, one fact will be interpreted in many, many different ways, right? The more divided we are, the more the different reactions and opinions and theories we will have. So maybe this is a huge question, but you know, I think the goal is also to find a way to overcome those divisions.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing disinformation campaigns and countering disinformation with Cornelia Biola of the University of Oxford, Nora Benavides of Free Press, and Ella Dreskowitz, the Slovak Academy of Sciences. Cornelia, I know one of the campaigns has been to try to identify where the disinformation is coming from. I know in the 2016 US election, there was so much emphasis that this is all coming from Russia, or you know, some of the different COVID disinformation campaigns to try to identify where is it coming from as a means to try to address the veracity, the accuracy of the information. How effective is that as a campaign to try to address disinformation?
It's a whack-a-mole game, because it pops up everywhere. And I think what we see with this information can easily adapt. And I think it also prompts us the question, how are we doing now as a society, as individual, comparing with 10 years ago, right? When this information, you know, started to move very aggressively through social media channels. Are we better off in terms of, you know, being more resilient? I hope so. I mean, we started to recognize, I mean, when the phenomenon of trolling emerged in 2014, we were surprised, we didn't expect. Now, sort of, we adapted a little bit. So this information evolves, it adapts. And one thing about us, we like to think, right, that we adapt as well. So there is something about that, the positive school of thought thinks that we can adapt. How do we adapt? By building what is called media literacy. In Finland, for instance, they train kids in the primary school. They introduce courses to identify fake news. So the idea is that you have developed this kind of immunity to understand the basic stuff, right? What's the source? Is it the source, you know, reliable? Can we check it? Is it trying to get your around your cognitive filter, right, by putting a lot of emotions in your message, basic stuff. So I think there is something. There are legal measures, and Nora knows better than me on the legal measures. So there are, again, Finland I mentioned, because they took it to court, you know, for those who are promoting this information on the basis that I have a right as well to not to be exposed to this information that I don't want, not only to be able to express, because otherwise I cannot express myself. I think it ties back to Article 19, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So there is something about that in terms of the legal aspect, the positive school of thought. But, you know, I also like to refer to this interesting debate that started recently with Jonathan Haidt, who published an article in The Atlantic about, you know, the fact that the past 10 years have been lost. And his argument is that, look, society, it's becoming, you know, dumber in a sense. And why is that? Because the moderates or the institutions that actually provide the basis for checking the validity of different claims are being sort of pulled apart. These are universities, these are, you know, reliable newspapers, New York Times or whatever, you know, the type of journals that provide the basis to adjudicate between the competing claims. Otherwise, as a society, we'll go into different directions in which everybody holds to their truth and there is no possibility whatsoever to build consensus. So the question for, and I think his point is good, the social psychologist from New York University, Hyde, it's good. We need the center back. We need the as a society, we need the center back. And the center is provided by universities, in a sense, and also traditional, you know, the media, also, you know, institutions, in which this kind of discussion can be done on a basis that different claims can be validated somehow, right? Otherwise, this disinformation is going to destroy the social fabric. I don't want to leave, you know, the people with the, you know, audience with this kind of, you know, negative, depressing thought. But there is something important here to understand that the center means, you know, institutions that have been eroded by the rise of social media, that we have to bring it back and to hold to that.
Yeah, and Nora, since Cornelia referenced some of the legal approaches, I want to ask you, I know one of the greatest changes here in disinformation is when news analysis, et cetera, goes through traditional media, there's an editor because there's legal liability. Whereas when platforms, Twitter, Facebook, et cetera, are accused of posting misinformation, disinformation, they're shielded from liability laws. How effective would that be? Just to say, if it's posted to your platform, you're actually responsible for that information.
I mean, what you're ultimately getting at is what kind of liability the social media companies have. And there in the United States is one major impediment to reaching, quote unquote, getting at liability for social media companies, which is Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which essentially, and we won't do a full, wonderful, exciting legal history. I believe one or two audience members would find it gripping, like myself, and then no one else would. But, you know, Section 230 essentially says that if you are the intermediary, if you are opening up space for others' speech, you cannot be liable then for the content and the impact of that speech, which if we now think of present day, you know, the CDA Section 230 was passed almost 15 years ago. That was a very, very different internet era. And when it was passed, it was really with the intent to actually allow more discourse, more connectivity, hoping that we could really open up a global conversation so that people wouldn't be fearful of what comments would be doing on their own blog. It was just a completely different moment that we were in. Now, of course, people demonize 230 as the reason we do not have full accountability for social media companies and the role they play. And that really is, I think, an inappropriate weight that we give 230 when there are a number of other avenues that we can be taking on and considering in the legal sphere. You know, I'm a U.S. domestic lawyer. My expertise is here in the U.S. legal system. And so most of how I conceive of solutions is really what can the United States do? And beyond reforming 230, which there are current attempts to do, and some of them in beginning to take on bits and pieces of very thoughtful reform, creating exemptions to 230 in certain instances when it relates to human rights impacts. Those are worth discussion. Those are worth finessing, going through markups. I really think we need to be pushing Congress to do more in this space across potential reforms. But 230 isn't really everything, and many consider it a holy grail when it is not. And so there is a wider array of options. Some is let's employ litigation. For example, pushing news media to do better. The kinds of incendiary news stories that are ultimately defamatory, how might we pursue litigation to remedy the harm caused to, let's say, an election worker grossly attacked because of a fake news story or an entire fake news campaign initiated against that person? This is a real case that's happening. Many of these are trickling through US courts right now with respect to the 2020 election, which many said was stolen from Donald Trump, and election workers were grossly attacked after fake articles circulated about them and their role in somehow contributing to the thievery. These kinds of defamation cases are worth watching. There are some pitfalls, and I know we're coming up on time, and so I'll just sort of briefly say, one of my concerns is that we do not overcorrect to the point where we are both regulating and litigating far, far too much. One of the avenues on the table is let's criminalize any purveyor of disinformation. Let's even introduce criminal statutes. That's something that we've seen around the world, whether it is in the Philippines or Morocco or Brazil or even Puerto Rico here, you know, in the US. Those are really troubling precedents, which are often then used to target dissidents and journalists who try to report on something contrary to what authoritarian or, you know, demagogue leaders want told. in the same breath, if we are only criminalizing a single person, you know, a person who has initiated a disinfo campaign, that again doesn't get us where we need to get in the bigger narrative, take, you know, kind of like wrapping our arms around the problem here. And so as we consider solutions, I try to just always talk about what are the interdisciplinary set of interventions. And it brings me back to how we began, frankly, that we need all of the above, but they have to be very carefully crafted so that we are not creating unintended consequences because we are only thinking through the next year of problems. And so we need to vet these with everyone here. You know, this is a constant dialogue to discuss solutions the way we have now spent so many years discussing the problem.
Absolutely. I think that's a great place to end our conversation. I think some of our key takeaways here is the need to build media literacy, the need to build critical analysis, the need to engage. Ella Draskowitz, I think you had such an important point that what we don't need to do is to lecture and shout at people who are advancing these sorts of theories, but to try to develop some degree of empathy, but most importantly, to develop conversation about these topics, to explore these issues, and to approach this with concern, certainly some concern, empathy, compassion, because I think it's fair to say that these campaigns are here to stay. I want to thank our guests today. Our panel today is Cornelia Biola, Associate Professor in Diplomatic Studies at the University of Oxford and head of the Oxford Digital Diplomacy Research Group. He's the co-author of Countering Online Propaganda and Violent Extremism, The Dark Side of Digital Diplomacy, and Digital Diplomacy, Theory and Practice. Nora Benavides, Senior Counsel and Director of Digital Justice and Civil Rights at Free Press. She is also a faculty associate at Arizona State University's Cronkite Institute, where she teaches a course on freedom of expression in the digital age. She's the author of several pieces, including Facebook Ought to Be Protecting Democracy Every Day in the Boston Globe, and First Amendment Rights If You Agree with the President in the Atlantic. And Elzbieta Draskowitz, Senior Research Fellow at the Institute for Sociology and the Slovak Academy of Sciences. She is the co-author with Jaron Harambom of What Should Academics Do About Conspiracy Theories? Moving Beyond Debunking to Better Deal with Conspiratorial Movements, Misinformation, and Post-Truth, and Taking Vaccine Regret and Hesitancy Seriously, The Role of Truth, Conspiracy Theories, Gender Relations, and Trust in the HPV Immunization Programs in Ireland. Thank you very much.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankina Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Seb Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org. And our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.